I hope some people are watching this one, this lecture. Okay, we're going to, I think we'll start now. Now today we're talking about tariffs and trade restrictions. We're going to find that, again, this one thing I've been stressing in these lectures, I've tried to show that the basic principles of economics are easy. I hope I haven't complicated things unduly. Sometimes I try to make things easy and I don't do a good job and people say I've made it more complicated than it was before. But this time I think we can do it, so we'll see it really is easy. And one reason I think you'll see it really is easy is it will be using some of the things we learned in the previous lecture, especially in the first lecture. Now, I think the most important principle to remember in thinking about tariffs is one we covered in the first lecture. Now, you know, all know what a tariff is. It's a tax on goods that are imported. So a tariff would be, supposing, say, someone is selling a car for, say, there's a car available for $20,000, so you could buy it in the U.S. for $20,000. But if, say, there was a comparable car, say, it was produced in Japan, you might have to pay an extra, say, an extra $1,000 as a tariff. So that would be a tax on the foreign goods that is being imported. So if we want to understand, think about tariffs, we have to remember a principle we covered in the first lecture, which is whenever you make an exchange, you want more, you want what you're getting more than what you're giving up. If, say, you wanted to get the my lectures more than the $95 you spent for them, then you would make that exchange. If you didn't want to, you'd rather have your $95 than be in my course, then you wouldn't have joined the course. Of course, now that you've spent the money, now you're probably regretting that you spent the money, but it's too late to drop out. I'm sorry. I'm very happy about that myself, but it's too late. But you can see you're not going to make an exchange unless you want what you're getting more than what you're giving up. Doesn't matter if it's money or anything else that you're trading. And when you're in a trade, the other person, the person you're trading with, also wants what he's getting more than what he's giving up. So there's a reverse in the valuation thing. You'd rather have your you'd rather give up your $95 to hear me lecture, and I'd rather have $90 than the labor involved, the cost of the labor involved in giving the lecture. So I'd rather give up, perform, I'm willing to perform the service of lecturing for $95, so I rate getting the $95 more than whatever exertion is necessary for me to give the lecture. So this is true in any exchange. Now, why is this important? Why do we mention this, this basic principle in connection with tariffs and foreign trade? It's that there's, we have to see this, when I said this, this principle, you value what you get more than what you give up in any exchange. This doesn't have any geographical limitations. It's not just, say, if you make exchanges within a single city or single country, that's the case. It happens in any exchange. It doesn't matter if there are foreign countries involved. Say, I'm in America and I trade with you. Some of you, a lot of you are in various foreign countries. This principle still applies. I might think that's a kind of stupid point to make. Everybody would see that this obviously case that you're going to trade only if you value what you get more than you give up. Who would think that that's just confined to one country? But a lot of people do make that mistake. They think there's some kind of basic difference between foreign trade and domestic trade, and there are completely different principles that apply, but that isn't the case. This basic principle applies in all trade. Now, so we know, because I've said it enough times, remember there's a character in Lewis Carroll's poem, with Hunting of the Snark, said, whatever I tell you three times is true. I said this many more times than three times, so it must be true. You know, whenever an exchange takes place, the parties expect to benefit. But that doesn't tell us how important exchange is. I mean, we might have a case where you don't engage in exchange if you benefit from it, but what if people very rarely do benefit from exchanges? That's a logical possibility. But in fact, trade turns out to be extremely important. Imagine, supposing you have to grow all your own crops, build a house, make clothes entirely by yourself. If you imagine state affairs like that, almost nothing would be produced. Many people, including myself, would be completely helpless. I wouldn't be able to grow food at all. I'd starve if I had to try to grow food myself. I just don't know how to do it. So we're all very much dependent on trade. In say, we go back to the prehistoric times, there wasn't very much trade. Only very few people were able to survive prehistoric. Men and women lived in very small bands, and they couldn't support a large society because they didn't have the benefits of trade. So it's not only the case that whenever an exchange takes place, parties expect to benefit, but exchange is extremely important. One reason for this is if people don't try to produce everything for themselves, if people don't say, well, I'm gonna build a house, so I'm gonna do that myself, I'm gonna grow my own food, get everything for myself. If people specialize in particular jobs and trade with one another instead of producing everything by themselves, then they'll be able to produce much more. So the key question to ask is, why is that? Why will they be able to produce much more if they don't try to produce everything by themselves? Well, one very obvious thing to remember is people have very different abilities. Say some people are very good at building houses. As I mentioned, I couldn't do anything in that area at all. If I don't even know which end of a hammer to use, that's why I rarely use a hammer. I'd end up with broken fingers very easily if I did that. So people have different abilities, and if people specialize in what each one does best, then they're obviously going to be able to make more than if each person does a little of everything. Say, if I need to have a new chair, I'm obviously going to get a chair faster if I just go down to the store and buy it from someone, some people who've been able to produce it. And if I tried to make a chair myself, I wouldn't have the faintest idea of how to do it. And even if I did, I'd be much slower. I'd waste a lot of time trying to build it. So you see, it is called division of labor. People are specializing in particular tasks, and this makes them much more productive than they would be if they tried to do everything. Everyone tried to do everything by himself or herself. Now, it's not only that people have different abilities, but particular places are more suitable for producing certain things than others. the surface of the Earth isn't composed of identical areas. There are vast differences in what you can produce in different parts of the world. Obviously, there's a comment here. Let me just read this. Someone says, that's only because when I said I'd starve, it's only because I knew the choice was starve and study economics or learn do other stuff, you'd probably pick other stuff. I'm not really getting that. I'd probably pick other stuff if I could, but what if I just didn't know anything about the other stuff and couldn't work in it and I'd be dependent on other people? I'm not sure I'm getting that the question, but I'm probably not one of my lack ability is always to pick up what people mean by their questions. I'm not really getting that one. But okay, so particular places are more suitable for producing certain things than others, and you couldn't mine gold or coal if these materials aren't around, or not all areas are good for farmland. If you go into central Manhattan, it wouldn't be a good idea to start a farm, try to start a farm on one of the streets. There are obviously certain areas of the world are much better than others. Now, so we have we've given two things so far, that people have different abilities, and then different parts of the world are different. These are ways that why the dividing labor, where we have people specialize in particular things, is much more productive. People try to do everything by themselves. If they divide their labor, then they trade with each other. This is why trade is very important. Now, besides these natural differences, where you have differences of ability, where, say, somebody's very good at, one person is very good at building things, somebody's a good farmer, and so on, and differences in areas where they work, we also find that, suppose you just start with people, basically have similar abilities, people who work on a particular job tend to get better at it if they are in the job for a while. So you were working, let's say, as a carpenter, this is something you were good at. Let's suppose there was somebody else who had equally good abilities. He could be an equally good carpenter to you, but he went into something else. So if you kept up working as a carpenter, you'd become much better at it after a while than he would be, simply because you're working at that job. Say in academic disciplines, why is it that, professors usually know more than the students? That isn't always the case. There's some pretty incompetent professors around, but professors usually know more than the students, even students who are very interested in the subject. Well, the reason for that is obviously they've been working on the subject for a very long time, so they get to know it. It's just because they're in the job. So even if they don't have any greater natural ability than the student, they get to know it. I remember when I was, my favorite professor at UCLA, Walter Starkey, once gave a course in Don Quixote. So I noticed when he was lecturing, he would be able to say he was reading, but you could see he was reciting from memory page after page of the book of Don Quixote. And I asked him how he could do that, and he said, well, when you've been reading a book for 60 years, you get to know it pretty well. So you see, this illustrates the point I'm making. If you're specializing one thing, you concentrate on that, you'll get to be good at it, so you'll be able to be very productive. And we have a system where people specialize in things, and that's another reason it's more productive than people trying to do everything by themselves. Now, we still haven't finished yet. There are still more advantages to the division of labor. One thing is, division of labor makes possible large accumulations of tools and machinery. These are called capital goods. Now, if you were just self-sufficient, trying to produce everything by yourself, you wouldn't be able to amass all sorts of tools and machinery because you'd be too busy trying to make a little bit of everything. So if you're specializing in something, you're going to have, for the reason I explained already, you know, different abilities, different places and practice of doing the same thing, people are going to be more productive. And this permits them to save up so they can make, they can accumulate tools and machinery, and then they become even more productive than they were before. So this is still another advantage of the division of labor, that you can use capital goods. And just one thing, be sure, this is very important in economics, don't confuse capital goods with capital. Capital is a money measure of the capital goods. But the capital goods are the actual tools and machinery themselves. So when you, sometimes there's ambiguity, people talk about capital, you have to be very careful whether what they're talking about is tools and machinery or just the money that's being used to measure these tools and machinery. Now, we said another advantage of division of labor, we have quite a few so far. We've got the natural different abilities, different places. We've got the practice in one doing particular jobs and accumulation of tools and machinery. Now, one advantage very much related to accumulation of tools and machinery is sometimes we can have what's called an economy of scale. I remember in the last lecture we were discussing law of diminishing marginal returns. Remember what that is? Say you have different factors of production. Let's say you need I gave example in Walmart, you have various goods for sale and you need people on the floor to sell them. So the law of diminishing marginal return says if you hold one of these factors of production, that they keep the goods on the floor constant, and then you keep increasing the other, say the number of salespeople, you won't, after a while, keep increasing what's produced. You won't, say, get more and more sales the more people you put on the floor to sell things. You'll reach a point where they don't get in each other's way, so you won't be able to keep increasing. By just increasing one factor, you won't be able to increase productivity indefinitely. Now, however, remember, there's one thing, this doesn't operate instantly. It isn't the case that any time you increase one factor production, you're going to get diminishing returns. You can have increasing returns for a while as you get, as say, if you keep one factor production constant and add another factor, keep adding to the other factor. For a while, in some cases, it just depends on how it works out. You can get increasing returns. So in some cases, if you accumulate enough tools and machinery, you can find you're not only producing more, but you're getting much more out of the output than you were at first. Your rate of return is going up, and this is called an economy of scale. So this is still another advantage of division of labor. You can sometimes have economies of scale. If people tried to be self-sufficient and didn't trade with each other, then you wouldn't have this. So you can see there's a vast number of advantages to division of labor. Now, how far does this go? How far can increases in productivity caused by division of labor go? Well, what would limit this process? Now, this, I think you should be able to see from what I've said so far, unless I've been even less articulate than usual. What I've said so far is that this, for all the reasons I mentioned, it's much more productive to have division of labor where people and resources are specialized in if people just try to produce, be self-sufficient, and did engage in trade. So you can't have division of labor unless you have trade, because people are just producing, say, one particular thing, then they need to get all sorts of other things in order to survive. That's the whole point of the system. They trade with each other, they specialize in particular things, and they trade with each other. So if you don't have trade, then you're not going to have division of labor. And what limits the division of labor and the productivity you can get with it is just whatever limits trade. If, say, trade is restricted, say, to a particular country, then this limits the advantage of division of labor to what you can get within the particular country. And there's one of the most famous sentences in economics comes from Adam Smith, who famous book, remembers great book, 1776, The Wealth of Nations, which was one of the foremost defenses of free trade. And he said, the division of labor is limited by the extent of the market. You know, if you read any history of economics book, you'll encounter that sentence. And now you'll be able to understand what this means, that if there's limits to what people can trade, then this limits the division of labor. Because if you can't trade with people, then you'll have to produce things for yourself. You won't be able to trade with them. You'll just be dependent on your own production. So that will limit the extent to which you can make use of the division of labor. Now, of course, this applies to trade between countries. Again, you have to be careful to avoid thinking that there are separate principles that apply to trade within a country and between countries. The same principle applies. The advantage of the division of labor apply to international trade, not just to domestic trade. So tariffs, remember, it's a tax on trade. Tariff is saying if you want to import goods into a country, you have to pay a tax on them so the price is higher. So that limits trade. Similarly, an import quota for another kind of trade restriction. This says you can only bring in so much of a foreign good. Say we put an import quota on Japanese cars. That means even if people want to pay for them, there are a lot of Americans who want to buy these cars. They could only sell a set number, set by the quota. So if you have limits on international trade, this limits the international division of labor. It interferes with productivity. People, if you have more division of labor, you're going to have greater productivity. Now, you might think, just offhand, that there's a limit to what I've been saying. I've been saying, well, look how great it is. People can specialize, and then they can be more productive, and then they can trade with each other. And this is much better than if they try to produce things by themselves. Now, you might think that there's a limit. Suppose, say, that you're better at growing both apples and oranges than I am. And I'm sure if you're able to grow apples and oranges at all, then that would actually be true, because I wouldn't be able to grow any. So you're bound to be better than I am. But let's suppose I was able to just, say, grow them a little, but you're much better than I am. So you might think, why would you trade with me to get either apples or oranges? I'm really bad at apples or harvesting apples or oranges. I'm not very good at that. So wouldn't you get more by just relying on your own production? You think, well, why should I try to get any apples or oranges from that bozo? I'm going to just grow them myself. I'll do much better. But it turns out that if you thought that way, it wouldn't be right. And the great early 19th century economist, David Ricardo, this is a 19th century economist, but it was not the Ricky Ricardo of the I Love Lucy show. This is the 19th century economist. I should say one example of how old I am is I remember when I Love Lucy wasn't a rerun. Remember when it was first on television. But the Ricardo we're concerned with now is David Ricardo. So he showed that it isn't true. Remember, we're thinking, well, supposing you're much better at growing apples and oranges than I am, both growing apples and oranges than I am. So you might think you're not going to be better. It's not going to be your advantage to trade with me because you can get more apples or oranges by yourself and by relying on my puny effort. So Ricardo showed that isn't true. It will be to your advantage to specialize in the good that you have the bigger advantage in producing that you're much better at. Even though you're better in both, you should specialize in what you're most better at rather than try to produce both. So an example, suppose that you can harvest a lot more apples than I can, but only a few more oranges. So you're really good at apples, but you're good at oranges, but not that much better than I am. But you're a lot better at harvesting apples. So then, according to Ricardo, it would be to your advantage to specialize in apples and to my advantage to specialize in oranges. Of course, I'm going to be glad to find inferior in both apples and oranges if I can get any trade, make any trade at all with you. And you're going to be better off if you specialize in what you're best at. So even here's a very important piece of terminology. So you have an absolute advantage in producing apples and oranges. You're better producing apples and oranges than I am, but you have a comparative advantage in oranges because of the two, your margin of superiority is greater for oranges than it is for apples. It's greater for apples than it is for oranges. I got the thing mixed up from what I said before. So you're really better, much better producing apples than I am, but just a little bit better at producing oranges. So you have a comparative advantage in producing apples. And this is the thing that a lot of people miss. It's very important to get this, is I have a comparative advantage in orange production. Even though I can't produce oranges as well as you can, my margin of inferiority is less than it is for apples. So I have an absolute disadvantage, but a comparative advantage. And you'll see a lot of people will confuse us who aren't economists when they say comparative advantage. They think this just means advantage. So they think, well, comparative advantage means I am better at something compared to you. But that isn't the way it's used in economics and international trade, it's, I can be worse than you are but still have a comparative advantage because I'm even more worse than you in something else, so I have a comparative advantage in what I'm less worse at. I hope everybody can follow that because it's really important in understanding international trade. Now, here's an easier way. I think you can see the point of Ricardo's law. Suppose you're a very highly paid lawyer. You're also a skilled amateur carpenter. So you're probably better off to hire a carpenter to do household repairs because I suppose you're getting $750 an hour for your legal services. So you don't have to pay the carpenter anything like that for his services. So even though you could do a much better job than he could, because you're really a skilled amateur carpenter, so you're really good at it, it would still pay you to hire the carpenter rather than do it yourself. So here, the case I've constructed, the lawyer has an absolute advantage in both being legal service, being a lawyer, and carpentry. Say the carpenter can't practice law at all, but the lawyer is also a better carpenter than the person who's the professional carpenter. But he has a comparative advantage in working as a lawyer because the other person can't practice law at all. And the carpenter has a comparative advantage in being a carpenter over the lawyer, even though he's a worse carpenter than the lawyer is, but he's not as bad a carpenter compared to a lawyer as he is a lawyer compared to a lawyer. He's not a lawyer at all. So the inferiority in being a carpenter is less, so he has a comparative advantage there. So it would pay them to trade. So you can trade with people even if you're better at doing producing both the goods that you're exchanging. Of course, this applies not just to individuals, to people in, let's say, imagine trade between countries as well. Now, some people don't like free trade, and unfortunately there are quite a few of these, have raised an objection to Ricardo's law. Paul Craig Roberts is one of those, raised this objection. You probably read, if you read the Rocco page, he very often has articles. He's very good on certain things, but this is economic theory is one of its weaknesses. He was one of the supply-side economists in the Reagan administration. I think he was an undersecretary of the Treasury. But he has an objection to free trade. And now, what is his objection to Ricardo's law? Well, remember, the law is about cases where there's difference in productivity. We're talking about cases where somebody's better at producing, say, two goods than someone else, but it still works out. It's better for both of them to engage in trade. It isn't a case where one's better at producing both goods to just produce both by himself. It's still advantageous for him to trade. Why, we could ask, well, say there's a difference in productivity between trading people. Why is there a difference in productivity? Well, we can go back to what we said before on division of labor. One reason for the difference is that there are more capital goods, say, in one country than another. Say if there's trade, say, between the United States and Nigeria, well, we have a lot more capital in the United States. States than they have in Nigeria. So we're going to be more productive. That's one reason. The more productive, we have more capital goods. So can you, okay, so we can see what's the objection here. Now someone asked an interesting question here. Would it do it, you're all handymen, be better off in specialized rather than doing it all? Well, that would actually depend on particular circumstances. I mean, there might be a role for do it all handymen. It would just be, you would say, he's doing certain things and it might, and it wouldn't follow it, say, it would be a good idea to have someone just specialize in hammering nails, have somebody else say, specialize in taking out nails and knocking in right hand nails or left hand nails. But I mean, there it would just, you just have to find out what is the desirable amount of specialization. The point I was making, it turns out there's a lot of specialization. Should that be more productive? It doesn't follow that any time you could divide a task into more and more smaller parts, it would be better. That's just something that has to be worked out empirically. I won't resist the temptation to give you a joke here. There was a man who came into a hardware store, and he said that I'd like some right-handed nail. So the man said, why do you want right-handed nails? He said, because I need to hammer in a picture on the right side of the wall. So the owner of the store said, well, just gave him some regular nails. After he went out, he said, boy, that guy was an idiot. All he had to do, if he had left-handed nails, was hammer it on the left side of the wall. Well, I thought it was funny. Oh, good, I see Michael. Michael will get an automatic A in this class. Okay, so now we can get, good, now we're getting some action. Okay, so now we can get, what's the objection? Remember I've said, okay, in some cases, one trading partner will be more productive because he has more capital goods. So the objection is that Ricardo's law depends on holding capital goods fixed. So without this assumption, what would happen? Well, then the capital goods might move out of a less productive area entirely. So you couldn't be sure that it would be beneficial for them to trade, because maybe it would be better for the capital goods just to leave the less productive area entirely and go over to the more productive area. So this objection, Paul Craig Roberts, he's the only one that's raised this objection, he's the one who does it. But look, doesn't Ricardo's law depend on holding capital goods fixed? So how can this objection be answered? Well, the proper response is just, so what? All that this objection says is, in certain cases, the law depends on holding capital goods fixed. So it isn't a good objection to a theory that it applies only under certain conditions. It's just when you have the condition, then the theory applies. So it isn't a point against the theory that it applies only in certain conditions. But in fact, the objection really isn't right even on its own terms, because as Mises pointed out in Human Action, if you have Human Action, you should look up what Mises said about the law of association. Mises pointed out this law of comparative cost, or law of comparative advantage, isn't limited to cases with fixed capital goods. In Ricardo's original example, I think it involves something like trade between England and Portugal where you had fixed agricultural goods. So he said law of comparative cost isn't limited to cases with fixed capital goods. They can apply to any case where people of different abilities engage in trade. Like the same example I gave with a lawyer and a carpenter, that doesn't depend on fixed capital goods. So what means that is that Ricardo's examples are just part of a more general law of association. And Mises said, and I think this is one of the profound insights into the nations, that the law of association says people, regardless of their abilities, can benefit from associating with others in society and trading with one another. This is, he thought, this is one of the most basic principles of economics, this law of association. People, regardless of ability, can benefit from trade and exchange. Now, given that we know that trade only takes place when everyone involved in trade expects the benefit, the problem with tariffs and trade restrictions, which the import quota is obvious. Remember, the trade is going to take place only if it's the people's advantage. So if you have a tariff, it's a tax on trade, so it prevents or at least interferes with people acting according to their own advantage as they see it. And it tariffs interfere with the international division of labor. Remember Adam Smith, the extent the division of labor is limited by the extent of the market. So if you limit trade, say we have tariffs, this limits the extent which international division of labor can proceed, and it thus restricts productivity. Now, there's, as you no doubt know, even though this is a very simple argument for benefits of trade, a lot of people don't accept free trade. They have all sorts of objections. The most popular objection to this, popular objection to the standard argument for tariffs that was characteristically stupid is they would say, well, even if the parties to a trade expect to benefit from it, suppose they're right, say, I'd like to buy a Japanese car. I don't know what I'd do with it since I don't drive, but I'd like to buy a Japanese car. So I expect to benefit. The seller expects the benefit from selling it to me. But what about third parties? Say, foreign car sellers undersell American car makers and drive them out of business. And the manufacturers of these American cars, the workers they employ, are made worse off. So free trade, according to his objection, doesn't make everybody better off. It might make the parties to the trade better off. But what about the other people that it affects? Now, one point that Henry Hazlitt made in your if you've done the reading, you'll be familiar with this, is, as it pointed out, it's true, at least in the short run, that people in the American car industry will be worse off under free trade and under tariff if they're undersold, say, and they go out of business, that isn't very good for them. But it doesn't follow from this, say, imagine American car workers lose their jobs or they don't employ as many of them as they would if there weren't foreign competition. It doesn't follow that total American employment will fall. And to understand this, we have to remember another thing I discussed in the first lecture, remember the famous broken window fallacy, where we just, this is an example where someone has thrown a brick through a glass window, and you think, well, it is going to help the economy because people will have to get the window repaired. This will generate all sorts of spending. So what the fallacy is overlooked is that if the window wasn't broken, we'll just be spending on something else. So it's one of the basic fallacies. If you commit it in a blatant enough fashion, then you can win the Nobel Prize for economics. But how is the broken window fallacy applied here? Well, consumers who pay lower prices for foreign cars, the prices are lower because, remember, we're assuming that the foreign car is underselling the American car. That's why it drove it out of business. They have more money to spend on other things. So when you're if you're thinking that American employment will fall because American workers have been put out of business, this neglects the fact that consumers pay lower prices now have more money to spend on other things. So there won't be any loss in employment. And in fact, we can expect employment to go up because resources are being used efficiently, more efficiently than before, since the foreign car manufacturers are able to supply the cars at a lower price, so they're using the resources more efficiently than the American manufacturers who are driven out of business were able to do. Now, the pro-tariff advocate isn't going to give up at this point. He can say, all right, total employment won't go down, but American employment will, because the money spent on foreign cars is leaving America. So it might be that this money will help employment in other countries, but what good does that do us? And I actually heard people arguing this way. There's a restaurant in Los Angeles I go to very frequently. And one of the waitresses is from Thailand, and she sends a lot of money that she makes to her family over there. And so one person, the manager there, was saying, oh, she didn't like this because she said, you're making money in America, you should spend it in America. Why? Because if you're spending the money, sending it to Thailand, that's going to benefit the Thai people, but not Americans. So you see, people actually do give this sort of argument. So this objection isn't a very good one, because when dollars are sent abroad, what are the buyers going to do with the American money? Well, either they're going to spend the money on American goods, or they'll have to exchange the American money with those who intend to use it to buy American goods. And when money is spent on American goods, this increases American employment. So when people are thinking, well, we're sending money abroad, they're forgetting that the money is going to be used to buy American goods, so it's really helping American export industries, and that's where employment will go up. So one way of looking at which many of the classical economists, such as Jean-Baptiste Say, the early 19th century French economists, say that exports really pay for imports. So if you're imagine America is importing cars, or we're sending the money that sends money out of the country, so then the foreigners are going to buy American goods. So you can take and see the money is really linking the imports and exports. So the exports are paying for the imports, you see. Now, another possibility is that foreign holders, and suppose you have this American money, say Americans bought Japanese cars, so the Japanese now have a lot of American money. Well, what are they going to do with it? Well, what if besides buying American goods, they could invest it in the United States? They could just say, well, they're going to invest this money. We're not going to buy anything. We're going to invest it in American companies. And this, again, creates American jobs. Now, let's say they didn't do any of these things. Say they didn't buy any American products or exports, American exports didn't go up. And then they didn't invest in anything in the United States. So what would happen then? Well, then they'd just be giving away the goods that Americans have imported, because if they're not using their dollars to buy anything or to invest in anything, so then all that would happen would be they wouldn't be, their dollars wouldn't be competing with any the American dollars. It wouldn't be taking, they'd be in effect giving us the goods that they send into the country, so that they're not very likely to do that. They're not going to be giving us these cards for nothing. It would be if we send them the money but they don't do anything with it, then really they haven't. No one has lost anything by buying it. And the Americans haven't lost anything by giving up the money. We'll have the goods, but they're not taking away anything from us with the dollars we give them. Now, people often, you talk about an unfavorable balance of trade, you'll see very frequently in the newspaper that America has a very large unfavorable balance of trade. What is an unfavorable balance of trade? It's one where exports are less than imports, so we're importing a lot, but we're not sending that many goods abroad. So the thing, very important thing to realize, and this is why I put unfavorable in quotation marks, it's nothing bad about this when you see things. It's a very misleading piece of terminology, because we can see this from what I said before. Why is there nothing bad about it? Because if you have more imports and exports, so that would mean either foreign money is being invested in America, or the foreign goods are just being given away. You see, so there's nothing bad about unfavorable balance of trade. Now, there's one complication here I'm not going to get into, because it's a much more advanced topic. And I don't, this is an elementary course, and it's not that you couldn't understand this more complicated stuff, but I'm pretty sure that I don't understand it, so that's why I don't want to go into it. At least I want to think about this topic to try to figure out what I wanted to say about it. It's too much trouble, so I said, let's forget the whole thing, let's just concentrate on this part. Well, the complication would be where the foreign debt affects the value of money. You're going to say, but this is a very advanced topic. You know, you could see, example, say they didn't spend anything, say they just got money, didn't do anything with it. It would affect the purchasing power of money. Say if dollars were just withdrawn from circulation, then purchasing power of money would rise and prices would fall. But monetary economics, we'll say, is a very difficult subject. And fortunately, we're going to forget about it in this course. So far, we've been arguing that free trade doesn't reduce employment, even if, say, American workers are put out of employment because they're undersold, still, this isn't going to reduce employment overall, because American consumers have more money to spend, and it isn't true that if the money is sent abroad, that reduces American employment, because, again, they have to. The foreign holds of dollars will have to be invested in the U.S. to buy American goods. And we can see that since trade expands the division of labor, it will increase productivity and employment. Now, somebody might object, well, even if free trade makes the economy better off as a whole, aren't some people hurt by free trade? What about them? What if you say, well, look, this is all very well, but what about these automobile workers who were hurt by free trade? Oh, I see one question here. Let me just have a look at this. If exports are less than imports, this subtracts from GDP. Is this part of a GDP calculation? Unnecessary. Well, Jay, that's a very good question. I'd have to really look that up. I'm not really familiar with the details of how the GDP calculations are made. So I'd really have to check in that for you. So I'll try to find that out. Okay, so let's get back. Probably maybe the people who knocked out of work by having the American car workers who lost work and get another job trying to do research and figure out the answer to your question. Okay, so the objection here is, well, aren't there some people who were made worse off by free trade? What about them? Now, the problem here, and this is actually a very deep point made by Murray Rothbard. This objection rests on taking all the people in a particular nation as an important unit in economic analysis. What way does it depend on this? Well, we're saying these people, these car manufacturers, the workers are made worse off. So this poses a problem. And the question would be, well, why does it pose a problem? Because we're considering them sort of as part of the, considering sort of America, we're considering all the American workers, and we're saying this particular group of American workers is worse off. So this poses a problem for us. But what Rothbard pointed out is there's really nothing special about the nation. If tariffs are supposed to protect particular national industries from foreign competition, well, why don't we have tariffs for cities or neighborhoods? You could say, well, if New York imports oranges from Florida, won't this be hurt anyone who's trying to grow oranges in New York? Why don't we have a tariff over there? And what about these orange growers who were put out of business by cheaper, better Florida oranges? So what Rothbard points out, well, of course, we say this is silly. We don't demand, when we're looking at domestic trade, we don't demand that trade benefit, we don't demand that nobody be made worse off by particular trade. We don't say, well, okay, this restaurant is very good for the people who like to eat there, but it's put out of business these other restaurants, so don't we have to compensate them? Say McDonald's puts out some more expensive restaurant, puts them out of business in a neighborhood. We don't say, well, we've got to compensate the owners of this other restaurant. So what Robert says is, well, why do we think there's anything different with nations? Why don't we just say, well, all right, this particular group has been undersold, so why does it pose a particular problem that there's foreigners who are the ones who are putting them out of business? Why should we assume, for the purpose of economic analysis, that the nation is an important unit? Now, there's just want to conclude with a couple arguments that are sometimes used in opposing free trade. One of these is called dumping, and this doesn't refer, say, to throwing out garbage, but what the dumping objection is, some defenders of tariffs will say that foreign competitors, American firms, get subsidies from their government, and then they can drive American firms out of business by selling below cost that we screw up. So say, imagine some struggling American business trying to get by, but the foreign business gets money from the government so they can undersell them. They say, well, isn't this unfair? They're gumtree. But what we have to realize is that this benefits American consumers. Say they're able to buy the products at very low prices. So we want to ask, well, why are those American firms that were driven out of business by gumtree, why are they entitled to protection if domestic firms are not? What's so special about these American firms that they should be protected from extra low prices? Now you might say, oh, but look, isn't it unfair that these American firms have to compete with foreign firms that are getting subsidies? They don't get any subsidies, but the foreign firms do, so isn't that unfair? But remember, when we're talking about economic competition, we're not talking about something like a race where we're trying to make sure that everybody starts from the same point. Say, if you imagine people running a 100-yard dash, it wouldn't be a fair race if, say, somebody could start at the 90-yard line, the other person had to start at the beginning. The first person wouldn't have much of a chance, unless, of course, I was the one starting at the 90-yard line. I'd still lose, because I can't run at all, walking hard enough. But economic competition isn't like that. It isn't something that we're trying to say, well, everybody has to start off from a particular fair starting point and see who's the winner under certain fair conditions. We're just trying to benefit the consumer. So this dumping really isn't much of an option. It's really benefits consumers and shouldn't be taken as a good objection to free trade. And the last objection I'll mention is a very frequent one called the infant industries argument. Alexander Hamilton, the early years of the American Republic, was one who used this argument. This argument is that a new industry very often can't immediately compete with well-established foreign firms. Supposing, say, imagine a country just become independent, so they decide to set up a steel factory. Well, it might take them a long time before they acquire necessary expertise to start producing steel in competition with well-established in the steel industries elsewhere. So the argument is, well, if the infant industry gets protection for a while, then it can gain experience and then compete effectively. So it needs to have a tariff so it can acquire some experience, but then it will be able to compete without the tariff. Now, of course, it turns out that they never do give up the tariff, at least this is the theory of it. So what are the problems with the infant industries argument? Well, first of all, if you have these subsidies by the tariff, this raises the prices for consumers, so the consumer could get lower prices, meanwhile has to pay higher prices while the infant industry is supposedly learning how to produce things, so being in competition with, eventually being competition with the foreign industry. So again, you see, this argument is committing the broken window fallacy, saying, well, look, eventually this industry, if things work out all right, it's going to be able to compete on the basis with these other companies. It won't need a subsidy. It'll be generating a lot of jobs for American workers, let's say. But what it's ignoring is that if you didn't spend the money trying to build up the infant industry, then we'd be spending the money on other things. So you see how it's the broken industry, broken window valve. And then the further question is, you could ask is, well, why is it desirable at all to build up a firm faster than the unhampered market would do? Why should we say, if, say, you needed the experience, why should we say that we should try to build this firm up if the market isn't doing it on its own? And suppose somebody said, well, look, it's going to be a good investment because, say, this firm's going to be very productive, just needs a little time to get going, then private investors who think that are perfectly free to invest in the firm and then say they're going to forego profits throughout because they speculate it would be worth it for them, so there's no need to bring in the government. Well, I think we'll stop now. So then, Tanya Rain will have questions. Please put your questions in this Q&A thing, which I'm going to click on this video thing, so I'll be able to see the Q&A box if this works. Okay, so we have, it didn't work. I just got the chat. Oh, here's the Q&A. Let me just expand. Okay, so here we have one from Douglas. Since the 1970s, international trade will expand exponentially, as has the division of labor. I would expect that my labor would be worth much more than it was then. But statistically, we can hardly buy more with an hour of work than we could then. Why? Well, that's a rather tough one. Let me see, go over this again and say, international trade has expanded, as a division, so you expect your labor to be much. Now let me see, could we answer that? International trade has expanded, division of labor would be worth, we can hardly buy more than an hour of work than we could then. Well, you know, that's a very good question. We could say in general that wages tend to follow the productivity of labor. I mean, it could take quite some time for that to actually occur in concrete instances. Remember, there can be other factors that reduce the productivity of labor. Say, we have, say, a lot of interventionist measures in the economy that reduce productivity. So even, so imagine, say, if we had international division of labor just operating by itself with nothing else, then productivity would go up, because that would expect wages to go up. But there could be other things that are happening that reduce wages. Say we have government intervening, or say one thing, say one example, say they have an inflationary monetary policy that eventually causes depression and dislocates the economy, or say we have wars going on that decrease productivity. We could have laws, say, interfering with employment, maybe wage laws, other things. So we would have other things. I would say I'd have to look in detail what was going on there. But we would say if, in fact, wages haven't risen to the extent you would expect from increasing international division of labor, there must be other things that are interfering with the free market that are causing them to go down. Okay, so now, what would be Mises Rothbard opinion on nowadays China, such as dumping trade, et cetera? Well, I mean, I think as far as dumping would be concerned, they you say, well, this is fine. I think the problems might be, they'd say they think when we talk about investment, you know, some of the investment that the Chinese are making is in, a lot of it is in government bonds, and reason Rothbard would be, would think it's government bonds aren't really good thing to have investment. We could talk about if it were investments in the domestic economy, that would be fine, but investments in government bonds can create problems with the monetary system. So that was one of the things I did not get into in the lecture. This is one of the complications. You can sometimes have problems with the monetary system if you have extensive government debt. So I think that might, that would be one thing they would want to be cautious about. And Matthew said, I don't understand, he said sending money to foreign countries means spending the money spent on American product. Why couldn't the money be used to buy the foreign goods? Well, okay, supposing say you're in Japan and you say you got say $10,000 in American money, you go into a Japanese store, you know, you have to have Japanese money to buy Japanese goods. So it's like, I couldn't say, I'll give you an example. When I was once in a conference in Portugal and I got some euros, they were foolish enough to pay me for my talk. So I couldn't take these euros and just go into an American store and buy things with them. Rather unusual. I have to exchange my $10,000 for Japanese money. So the thing is that the person who, someone would eventually have to use the American money to buy American goods with it, because otherwise it would be worthless to it. You would have to buy American goods to invest in American products. You see, because you want to buy domestic products, you have to use the currency, the domestic currency. And let's see, Patricia said, then they would encourage more direct investment in infrastructure. Well, that would be up to whatever the people thought was the most productive use of their money. One thing, there's more infrastructure, you have to be very careful. There are some, you find President Obama's always talking about infrastructure. But some people think, well, things like roads and bridges have to be built by the government. There's no reason to think that, but the market is perfectly capable of supplying those and do it more efficiently. So all I was suggesting, I think Rothbard needs would be a bit careful about building up large accumulations of government debt. You know, they would think it's not a good idea for government just to start selling bonds. Okay, so I think we have about another 15, 20 minutes or so. Anyone? Any other questions? Somebody should have something I can tell you. I'll tell you one anecdote. You mentioned Murray Rothbard. I remember when one big problem throughout, you know, Murray Rothbard was very friendly at one time with Pat Buchanan, but one problem he had with Pat Buchanan is very much in favor of protection rather than free trade. And that was one thing they always disagreed with on. So I remember once Pat Buchanan sent me a copy of one of his books, and he wrote on it, he had a little card, he said, "Don't read the chapter on free trade." Okay, so everybody understands international trade. Oh, here's no, that's the same question. Okay, let me see. Well, maybe I'll ask you, does everyone understand what the difference is between comparative advantage and absolute advantage? Oh, good, good. Everybody understand. Oh, good. So everybody understanding that. Yes, that's right, Michael. The same law applies between measures. One of the good way to think about if you have problems with international trade is just treat it the same way you would domestic trade. There's a lot of unnecessary complexity because people say, well, we have to have special, you know, we're dealing with foreigners. This raises all sorts of problems. But if you just consider it just trade between individuals, then it's much easier to understand what's going on. You see, we don't have, say, well, people wouldn't say, well, we need special laws, say, to protect New York from competition with California, but it isn't, you find a lot of people say we need to have laws to protect the United States from competition with Japan or Korea or other countries. It's not clear why we should think that. Now, someone, I think here's one I see in the chat. Christy has a very good point. Can we decide that tariff is not good by the economic analysis? This is a very good question. This is one that I'm going to cover in my economics and ethics class. I remember, economics isn't making any normative claims. And also, we can't strictly say by economics that tariffs are good or bad. Here, when I say that, I'm assuming certain value judgments that we're likely to hold, that productivity and employment are good things. We want to try to have more of them. All you would say in economics is just the description of the effect. Now, I see here's a point that Matthew makes. Mexican nationals preferred American dollars rather than Mexico. Yes, because, I mean, they want to spend them, presumably, on American goods, or they think that there are at least some Mexican businesses who want to will accept American dollars, prefer American dollars to Mexican peso. But remember, once somebody's going to have to spend these American dollars on American products, they can't just keep exchanging the dollars like some sort of game of musical chairs, you know, where no one ever spends the American dollars on American products. Question. Do you agree with Rothbard's attacks on Smith and Ricardo? Yes, I think, well, what Rothbard was attacking was not what they said about free trade, although he pointed out that Adam Smith, although in general he was in favor of free trade laws, accepted. But Rothbard was concerned to attack, you can get this in the first volume of History of Economic Thought, was they held different theory of value from the Austrian one. Remember, in the Austrian theory of value, we have values determined by the subjective valuations of people. So what determines, say, that a Lexus is worth more than a Ford, that people, consumers, value the Lexus more than the Ford. But what Smith and Ricardo thought is that the cost of production of goods determines their value. And Rothbard thought that was a basic mistake, and he was very critical of the view of before the, what's called the Marginalist Revolution of the 1870s, you had Karl Menger, Leon Walras, and W.S. Jevon had subjective utility. Before that, the dominant view was cost of production, especially second labor costs. So that was his main criticism of it. You can read that in his History of Economic Thought, one of the great books. Now, Patricia says, what emerging market nation follows the lessons of the Austrian theory? Which one do you expect to follow these ideas? I don't think there's anyone that's strictly Austrian. I think there's some. I think there's one. I think the Justice Minister of Lithuania is an Austrian. But I wouldn't want to make any prediction. I think just the extent that countries follow free market policy, they'll do better than they would otherwise. But I couldn't predict which countries would do that. Yes, I see in the chat, my concern is that cost reduction is false and does not take into account the subjective utility determines the cost. Again, that's also the Austrian view. The cost is really the utility of something in its alternate use. So you're quite right. You know your Austrian economics, that's a good point. And now here's one. Amber Kerr comment on the current trend of supporting fair trade over free trade. Well, that's an excellent question. This is fair trade laws are just restrictions on trade. This would be a very disadvantageous thing to do. For example, they would say, well, I mentioned this when I was in passing, when I was saying, discussing dumping, you know, some people say, well, isn't it unfair that American firms should have to compete with other firms that are getting subsidies from their government? But remember, I point out in economics, we're not concerned with some fairness in the sense we talk about a fair race, so we're not trying to establish which firm will win based on some sorts of conditions, as they would in an athletic contest. So another example of this is people say, well, look, if, say, in certain foreign countries, their labor costs are much lower than in America, the American minimum wage is about $7.25 an hour. In some foreign countries, that would be doing extremely well if you earn that much money. So how can you expect an American firm to compete with a firm that's really able to have very low labor costs? Again, we're not concerned with fairness in international trade. Also, remember, wages depend on productivity. So if the American worker is earning more, he's producing more also. So that's another reason to think that's not such a good argument. Now, what Michael says, what about immigration? What about the immigrants taking jobs argument? Does it make the U.S. worse off in Hazlitt's view? I don't think he discusses immigration in the book. I imagine he would say that in general it wouldn't, because remember, because of the nature of human wants, we always have things that we want and we like to be produced. Labor is always scarce in relation to the other factors of production. So if, say, foreigners come in, get certain jobs that American workers don't want, this would really release American workers to go to get other jobs. Now, it could, in certain cases, make them, or particular workers, worse off, but in general, there'd be, it wouldn't be the case that workers as a whole would be made worse off. But immigration is a rather more difficult topic to analyze than through trade. It's a somewhat different topic than we would have, but basically some of the principles are similar. Let's see, Erica asked the next question, how does the article treat trade when people are using gold and silver for currency instead of paper? Japanese person sells goods to America, then has gold he can use to buy anything anywhere. So what you're saying is, well, look, can't he just spend the gold entirely on Japanese products? So then wouldn't it be the case that there could be losses to America? Well, that's a very good point. I mean, it wouldn't be under that system guaranteed that what you're saying wouldn't happen. We would expect that from this, when we discuss the comparative advantage, we would expect that there would be some areas in which America would have a comparative advantage and people foreigners would buy from them. So your example would be saying, well, the Japanese, it's sort of, if you think about it, it would be kind of an unusual case. You'd be saying the Japanese person would be selling goods to the American, but there's nothing in America the Japanese wants to buy here. That would be kind of an unusual situation, would suggest there are no examples of things that the Japanese could engage in beneficial trade with us. So we would think that wouldn't be very likely. So you see, the argument would change, and we're not guaranteed that if you have American dollars, you have to spend them eventually in the U.S. If you have gold, it isn't guaranteed, but we could just still expect there to be substantial trade. Off topic, I'm going to ask, what is, in your experience, has been the best way to turn people on to free market capitalism? I think basically you could just give them some of the simple ideas. If you read Henry Hazlitt or some of the other books, it's a very good way to look at things, and you just have to study it a little bit, and then you'll be able to get into it. Now, Jay says ethics seems to be ignored in these economics discussions. Well, Jay, I'm going to have my last lecture, which is coming up. This is lecture number 4. Lecture number 6 is ethics and economics. Now, if I ignore ethics in that lecture, I'm going to be in real trouble. But I don't think I've ignored it altogether. Remember, I'm pointing out in the other lecture how we can't, economics is supposed to be value-free, so we don't get directly ethical conclusions from economics. However, there are certain values almost everyone tends to hold. So if we can say, well, I say, I've here benefit in excess of minutes, but interference or free trade is bad, I'm just assuming that certain values are good, certain non-controversial, I take to be non-controversial values are good. So you see. So, but it is an excellent question. I'm going to deal with that in lecture six. Well, let's see. Does anyone have a last minute question? I think we're about out of time. So thanks very much, everybody. I hope we'll see you all next week. Thanks, everybody. Bye. Thanks.